Ça m'arrive. No worries.
All right. I
click. Recording it. The little recording button looks like it's on.
Oh, is it? I just did it.
Oh.
Sorry about that. Yeah, too many things to think about.
No worries.
All right. Okay, so since we have discussed COVID, we should mention a case report from from our own people, including Christine Konopka and Jeff Myers, published a case report titled "Postmortem Lung Findings in a Patient with Asthma and Coronavirus Disease 2019. Okay, so the next paper, is from the Journal of Histopathology, and the first author is Jennifer Gordetsky. It's titled "Non-Necrotizing Granulomatous Pneumonitis and Chronic Pleuritis in Soldiers Deployed to Southwest Asia." So, during deployment to Southwest Asia, soldiers are exposed to various respiratory hazards, including dust storms, smoke from burn pits, and industrial air pollutants. And only a few studies have been reported which showed increased rates of constrictive bronchiolitis and asthma in these patients. So the aim of the study was to expand upon the pathological findings in this cohort. 59 veterans with a history of inhalational exposure and lung biopsies were identified in their files. Actually, this is from Vanderbilt. All patients had undergone pulmonary function tests and chest high-resolution CT imaging with no significant findings. So the patient had some symptoms, that's why they did the biopsies, but PFTs and the CT were negative. So they found a total of 59 cases. 54 of them were male and 5 female. And the age range was 24 to 55 years. Relatively few people were smokers. 4 of them were active smokers and 9 of them were former smokers. So the non-smoker group was the majority with 46 patients. Most patients had a video-assisted thoracoscopic lung biopsy, 97%, and 2 patients, which is a little more than 3%, had cryobiopsies. The deployment ranged from 2 to 60 months. Most of them were in Iraq, 2 of them in Kuwait, and 9 in Afghanistan. 47% was exposed to burn pits, 23% or 24% to sandstorms, and 57% to sulfur fires. The other group was represented by 8% of the patients. The follow-up duration was, mean duration was 54 months. The range was 3 to 188 months. And 65% of the patient had unchanged conditions, whereas 35% of the patient had worsening conditions. None of them improved. So as far as the results are concerned, first of all, 85% of the patient had constrictive bronchiolitis, which the authors do not discuss in this paper. 44% also had vascular changes which were not discussed. The main topic of discussion was non-necrotizing granulomas, which was present, which were present in 37% of the cases, 22 patients, and chronic lymphocytic pleuritis and or pleural adhesions, which was present in 75% of the patient of the patients, which is 43 individuals. So again, the authors focus on the non-necrotizing poorly formed granulomas, which were present in 22 of 59 cases, 37%. The granulomas were mainly bronchiolocentric and were associated with chronic lymphoplasmacytic bronchiolitis, similar to hypersensitivity pneumonia. Pleural reaction in the form of focal chronic lymphocytic pleuritis and or focal pleural adhesions were seen in 43 of 57 biopsies, which is 75% of the patients. It looks like the two cryobiopsies didn't have pleura in them, which is probably a good thing. From these new findings, the authors conclude that features of hypersensitivity pneumonia and pleural reaction can be present in veterans who served in Southwest Asia. I'm sure Tom is going to have some comments.
Yeah, they don't give a denominator.
The total number of soldiers, or yeah, that's true.
You know, this could be among 10,000 soldiers.
Right.
Or 1,000.
I don't think that's a good question. I don't think we had have that.
I mean, it used to be that in military recruits, there was always a subset of patients with sarcoid that were asymptomatic that were identified.
To me, it was a little curious that patients had both constrictive bronchiolitis, actually in 85% of the cases, and these non-necrotizing granulomas, so which was present in 37% of the cases. So I don't know how the constrictive bronchiolitis was related to this HP type picture. Do you have any comments on that, Tom?
Well, no, I totally agree. I mean, are the granulomas their disease? Or I'm actually surprised this paper was published, because they don't give the denominator of patients. They don't talk about maybe the constrictive bronchiolitis is why they were sick. Something happened to my iPad and it magnified the paper. I can't get down to actually read it. Were there CT scans done that showed any sort of airway disease?
Yeah, so the CT scans were negative.
How do they diagnose constrictive bronchiolitis?
I guess it was a previous pathology study.
Yeah, because Nashville is the place that studied a large series of patients that had that, what they called, Middle Eastern lung or whatever it was.
So they went through the pathological findings and they did find that many cases of constrictive bronchiolitis, but since that has already been published, they focused on the new findings, which was the HP like picture and the chronic pleuritis.
Well, then why the heck didn't they mention that in their earlier paper? If they had something that they called constrictive bronchiolitis 3 years ago in the New England Journal, and then now they're going back and saying, oh yeah, there's some granulomas there and we'll write those up. The whole thing just doesn't make sense to me. And you say the appearance looked like hypersensitivity pneumonitis. That sounds to me that it was classic for what Jeff and his group just called diagnostic of hypersensitivity pneumonitis. That one picture they show looks like HP. I guess I just don't understand this. And if the granulomas were only present in about 22, right?
Yes.
Yep. So but all their data was on their 59 or on the 22? I'm sorry, I can't get back to the paper. Boxes.
So the data were on the 59 cases.
And all 59 had granulomas?
No, 22 out of the 59.
So then technically their paper was about 22 cases.
No, because they also find lymphocytic pleuritis in 43.
Okay, now I got the... So that 22 had granulomas, and then they're reporting another 36 patients because they had focal lymphocytic pleuritis, which now I see the picture of, which is pretty common in a lot of biopsies.
Yeah, so
I was going to make that point. Pleural adhesions, I mean, how many times don't we see a pleural adhesion in a wedge biopsy and don't even think twice about it? I mean, I think they needed a control group of patients, I don't know, with other sorts of diseases, and to look for pleural adhesions to say that they're significant.
So again, Tom, the criteria for recruitment was for this study that the inhalation of exposure and lung biopsies, as far as I understand.
Yeah, no, and that's the place that's collected that big series of cases. Your comment about, they say there's vascular changes in constrictor bronchiolitis, but don't talk about those anymore. Maybe there's going to be another paper on the vascular changes coming up.
That's actually, I'm curious, how often do you see obliterative bronchiolitis type picture in HP in general?
Not very often, I don't think.
So I guess it's an interesting combination. It's too bad they focus only on one aspect of the findings.
Well, did they actually exclude the possibility of infection? I don't think you said anything about stains for microorganisms.
Or cultures,
yeah.
Good question.
Yeah, and if they're calling this HP, you know, a lot of this stuff is inorganic exposure. So dust, small, you know, you don't usually get HP from non-organic material. You know, rarely you get it, like with TDI, for example. So did they speculate on what they thought this was due to? And usually HP goes away after you're away from the antigen. So clearly these guys are, I assume guys and women are back in the States where they have their biopsies.
So I don't think we have all components of HP. I mean, we have the bronchiolitis component with poorly formed granulomas, but I don't think we have the chronic
interest. Well, I'm just reading your conclusion, Andras, which says HP may be part of the spectrum. So I haven't opened up the paper. I'm on my laptop and it's just sitting in my car. So, you know.
One of their figures would make a very good HP.
That's true.
Okay, fair enough.
That's true.
But I mean, then they need to speculate on what it is causing HP, and, you know, maybe the guy is a cat. I don't know, a bird. Not a cat, a bird. How about a bird?
Okay. So.
Anyway.
You
didn't write the paper, Andras. We get it.
Well, I thought there are things to discuss about this paper. I don't think it was the best paper this month, but it was definitely provoked interesting discussion.
No, I mean, I totally agree with you, Andres. There's something there. It's just that they seem to have mixed a whole bunch of things together, and we can't tease out what that something is.
I agree. All right. So the last paper is from Modern Pathology, titled "The Transcriptomic Data Helps Refining Classification of Pulmonary Carcinoid Tumors with Increased Mitotic Counts." The first author is Olga Sazanova, and it's from Canada. A recent paper came out from Sloan Kettering. I think Natasha Reckman was the first author, they discussed the same topic. But this is something we have encountered. We have all encountered. So I thought this might be an interesting discussion also. So this is just a reminder of. I just want to remind you that according to the 2015 WHO, neuroendocrine tumors are divided into typical carcinoids, which have less than 2 mitoses and no necrosis, atypical carcinoids, which have 2 to 10 mitoses and or foci of necrosis. And of course, the higher grade tumors, large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma and small cell carcinoma. And I think we have all encountered cases which look like a carcinoid tumor, perhaps an atypical carcinoid, without necrosis, but an elevated mitotic count. And this is a gray zone, which according to the current WHO needs to be classified as large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma because it does not meet the mitotic criteria for atypical carcinoid. So the aim of this article was to investigate clinical, pathological, and transcriptomic profiles of these tumors. The authors collected 18 cases, 7 carcinoids, 7 large cell neuroendocrine carcinomas, and 4 borderline tumors, which they defined as a mitotic rate between 10 and 30 mitoses per 2 square millimeters. In addition to histological and immunohistochemical evaluation, tumor-based transcriptomic profiles were analyzed through unsupervised clustering. So 3 of the 4 borderline tumors revealed a classical carcinoid morphology, histological analysis. So there were, again, 4 cases that were classified borderline. And interesting that the average mitotic rate were 13, 14, 17, and 26 in these 4 cases. And then 3 borderline cases were clustered in the molecular characterization of tumors using transcriptomic data. 3 borderline cases were clustered with the low proliferative group, and 1 borderline case was clustered with the high proliferative group. So out of the 4, 3 showed a classic carcinoid morphology and clustered with the low proliferative carcinoid group, and 1 case the case that had more than 26 mitotic index was clustered with the high proliferative group. So from these data, the authors concluded the following. The results support the emerging concept that neuroendocrine tumors with carcinoid-like features and less than 2 mitoses per 2 square millimeters should be classified as carcinoids instead of large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma. So, any comments?
Of course. You know, the current classification system for carcinoids is based on clinical behavior. And it's not based on genetic studies, transcriptomic data. So it's kind of apples and oranges here. You're using transcriptomic data to change a classification that is not based on transcriptomic data.
I think Natasha Reckman's paper actually did have some clinical correlation. So I think...
Yeah, but this one doesn't.
That's true. I think it just adds to the same discussion.
Did her paper come to the same conclusion?
I believe so. So it does look like that carcinoid appearing tumors that have a mitotic rate and therefore we cannot put them into the carcinoid category, but we have to classify them as large cell neuroendocrine carcinomas would have all the features of carcinoid tumors, including a better prognosis. So I think actually this is a reasonable proposal.
But their better behavior is more like atypical carcinoid, which if I recall is about 30% 5-year survival or something.
Yeah, I mean, that's correct. So it's not like, these tumors would behave as atypical carcinoids, not like typical carcinoids. And actually, if I remember correctly, the AFIP, I'm not AFIP. The Sloan-Kettering paper actually used metastases to look at these two groups. So
okay,
metastatic tumors that look like carcinoids and had an elevated mitotic rate more than 10. But didn't have the high mitotic rate and the appearance of large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma. Any other comments? It's 10 o'clock, right on time. Thank you so much for your participation. And Anya.
Thanks, Andras.
I'm sorry again for pushing the record button on time.
Oh, no worries. Andras, do you want to send me the recording what you have? I mean, even half of that is fine.
Okay.
Please?
I have never done this before, so I will try.
Yeah, as soon as you close it, you will see that it's actually saving.
I think if you want to record this, you really have to be good at multitasking or put somebody in your office to push the button.
We will figure it out eventually. But thank you very much. All right, I appreciate
thank
it.
Thanks, Andras.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
You too. Yeah.